I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to a brand new season of Going Underground, still broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. Today, while Britain gives away billions of dollars of weapons to fight Russia, it hosts the grand finale of the politically charged Eurovision Song Contest on behalf of Ukraine, such as the full spectrum cultural and military unity in Europe against Moscow. Joining me from Elite Military Post West Point in New York is a US soldier and veteran who has advised Ukraine's Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief, General Zaluzhny. Dan Rice, who won his Purple Heart in the Iraq War, is now president of the American University, which is in Ukraine. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show. So, I mean, in your capacity as Zelensky's commander-in-chief of Ukraine, as it were, how has your life changed since 24th February 2022?
Yes, great question. You know, obviously the war was shocking for the whole world and changed a lot of lives. Some lives forever, some are no longer with us, unfortunately, some many victims. For me, I became involved with the Ukraine war after I took in some refugees in Miami, and they were Ukrainian refugees, and I thought that would be the end of it, but it turns out one of them knew President Zelensky and General Zaluzhny, and they saw my West Point materials all about my house. I left them in my house.
What is General Zaluzhny like? Because, I mean, he was in the U.S. papers for getting $1 million from a Microsoft heir, Gregory Stepanets. What is he like?
Well, I mean, that's a great story because, you know, immediately when he received inheritance of $1 million, he gave 100% of it to the Ukraine Armed Forces. So he took $0. So he's a committed, humble servant, great sense of humor, very Western. He's he's broken away from the old Soviet style command and control. He's a great leader, and he has developed his leaders and subordinates to care about human life, to be much more humane than the old Russian Soviet style. And I think history will judge both he and President Zelensky were the right two people at the right time. You know, Zelensky leading the international effort and the political effort to get the world to rally around Ukraine, and then General Zaluzhny to focus only on winning the war.
I mean, did he know about the Thayer Leadership Institute that you're part of, where I think you're speaking to me from, which talks about the sort of cross-dimensional leadership styles and courses that you do, which is corporate as well as military.
Yeah, when I was introduced to his staff, you know, they vetted me to see who I was and what my background was. And, you know, I'm a West Point former Airborne Ranger qualified officer and served in Iraq. And, my partners and I started a company 13 years ago today, actually, and called Thayer Leadership at West Point. And our goal was to teach military leadership principles and learning to corporate executives. And so my background was very well suited to go advise Ukrainian military. And when I say advise, mostly what they needed was for me to help translate things back and forth between the U.S. Since there was no U.S. embassy at the time and there was no U.S. boots on the ground, still aren't, there was a big gap between the two armies. And so I kind of filled that gap.
You mentioned no American soldiers there, but I'm sure you're aware of the so-called U.S. mainstream media already covering the Pentagon leaks, which suggested that there are indeed U.S. forces on the ground. Do you think they'll be part of any counteroffensive? And when is the counteroffensive happening?
I don't believe there's any U.S. troops on the ground. I think all those leaks were rubbish. And I've seen certain parts of the leaks that I know were rubbish. So I think whatever those leaks were.
Why are they investigating them then? There's a subject of a multi-agency investigation into the leak. Well, if they're not true, why investigate?
Oh, no. I won't get into operational security things, but, you know, the enemy takes partial information that they gain through clandestine services, and then they rehash it, and they put in a lot of the things they want, people to think. So you can take two truths out of stolen information, add a lie to it, and suddenly everybody believes that all three are true. It's just a basic example.
No denials from Britain about the 50 UK special forces, and no denial from the US about the 14 US special forces.
You can never confirm or deny. Otherwise, you'd be caught in this thing where you're just denying, and then by not denying it, you're confirming it. So you never deny or confirm any of that stuff. So and even if there were 14 special forces, I mean, 14 people couldn't do much. But I've never run across.
It does seem a bit low. I mean, did Kirby handle it well? Did John Kirby in the State Department and the White House, have they been handling these leaks well? Because they said you know, the reporters there, which are not the hardest reporters in the world, they were going, well, if it's just all nonsense, and if it's, or as you suggest, half-truths or intermediary intel, why do announce loudly that there's going to be a multi-agency investigation? Because that suggests something is true in these Pentagon leaks.
Oh, I think if they believe there was some information leaked, it doesn't have to be all of it. So the it's not a binary thing. You don't have to say all of the information is true or all of it is false. It's because that's how the enemy operates. They take partial information. And so I know much of that is false that I've read. And so, but I am not going to confirm which I know and which I don't. But I do know that they can't go through and say, yeah, that one's true. Yeah, that one's false. Yeah, that one's true. So it's really obviously an operation that another foreign agency was involved with, in my opinion, my humble opinion. But just because of 21-year-old. Oh, I wouldn't even speculate. I mean, it's very sophisticated, so there's only a handful. But who wins out of this?
You're not going to tell me whether General Zelensky was irritated by it, I know. Was he irritated by the fact that there was all these stories from Seymour Hersh about the embezzling of U.S. public money? Did you see any when you were in Ukraine, U.S. public money valuable being wasted on Mercedes cars and the like?
No. I mean, most of the things I was working with were weapon systems and hard products, and they're treated like national assets. Like, nobody's going to take a javelin and sell it on the open market. Like, these things are treated, every single soldier, every commander treats these like gold. They know that their lives and their nation's existence depend on it. So, you know, any aid that came through, like a USAID that was funding to keep the government running or something, I would have no visibility to that. My work was mostly with the military.
Not
and
so much
systems.
On the black market weapons trading. I was thinking just luxury cars and lifestyles of those people in the capital as opposed to the frontline ordinary men and women on the front line fighting Russia.
Now, I can tell you that, you know, I think President Zelensky has implemented some very good policies and
anti-corruption. He sacked a load of people.
Well, he's done that, but he's also changed the laws. Like the anti-corruption task force used to not have any teeth. So they could suspect somebody, but they couldn't actually take it to a charge or take it to a court. Now they have teeth. And so these are fundamental changes in the laws that allow your process to work effectively. Because let's face it, there's corruption in D.C., but you need to have a good judicial system to be able to go after it.
There's corruption and corruption. I've been to K Street. You know, we had Andy Milburn, the head of the Mozart Group, which was fighting for Ukraine on the show. And I think it's dissolved now. I don't know whether you came across them, whether they were any help. I mean, they were called Mozart, obviously, as an echo of Wagner. Did you come across them?
No, I never came across him in person. I did correspond with him a little bit here and there. And I think he's a really stand-up, amazing guy. They had some issue with corruption within their organization.
He denied any
not
corruption.
Not Andy. Yeah, there was something going on there. So I think, and I would correct, I don't believe they were fighting. They were out, rescuing innocent Ukrainian civilians that were caught in the fire. And so they were doing some amazing work. I'd say from a humanitarian standpoint, they weren't like the Wagner Group, which is a mercenary group that actually is doing fighting for the Russians. So very big difference between what Andy put together and what the Wagner Group is doing. And, the atrocities and things that Wagner Group are doing on top of that just is it makes that a comparison. The only reason they're compared is because he named it the opposite of the Wagner Group. And so people compare them, but they're entirely different missions and people. And I think they did good work, but they disbanded due to internal issues.
You're saying that you admire Andy Milburn of the Mozart Group and saying they're very different to Prigozhin, who last I heard he was insulting the Russian government, actually, about lack of ammunition. But Milburn said that the Ukrainians are in violation of the Hague Convention and that he looked at this closely. He said there was an educational aspect, that Ukrainian soldiers were engaged in violations of international agreements, killing Russian soldiers who had surrendered, videoed them. Did you come across anything like that?
No, I haven't seen anything like that. And, I've seen the opposite. I mean, I think your Russian soldiers that are becoming POWs are being treated fairly, and they get sent home, and the prisoner changes, and they're fat, and they're very healthy, as opposed to the emaciated Ukrainians that come back having suffered torture and all kinds of things. So, in a giant war,
I mean,
like
that's
this,
coming from Milburn, someone you respect, saying the Ukrainians violating.
That's like asking a football player after a game, you know, what they experienced. The lineman and the quarterback have very different experience. So he may have seen things that I didn't. That doesn't mean I'm not going to challenge him. I'm just saying, I think the Ukrainian military, from my experience, has behaved incredibly professionally against a heinous, horrible horde of Russians that are raping, torturing, raping children, stealing, I mean, institutionalized stealing of children across all of Ukraine. You know, this is really fifth century horrible stuff. You know, if you have a soldier or two, I don't know how many Andy seems to have seen do something wrong on the Ukrainian side, I would think they would be charged and taken up.
They obviously deny all of that, and the denials on all the different sides. When is this counteroffensive that I know you've been appearing on occasionally on big networks in the United States about, when is it going to happen? And you in West Point right now must detect that there's a certain wariness on the part of NATO nation taxpayers funding this war. The Americans spending so much money while infrastructure collapses at home. What does Ukraine need, and when is the counteroffensive beginning?
You know, from a when it begins, obviously that's classified, and I don't have any classified information on the exact date. But I think you'll see that, you know, Bakhmut, the 72nd Russian Brigade, has largely been destroyed. A large part of Bakhmut has been taken back, which, you know, you can say that's a tactical offensive or it's part of the major counteroffensive. I think time will tell. Was that part of the main effort? But, you know, you don't attack in the spring. That was foolish for the Russians to try to attack in the spring. You can't attack armored vehicles through mud. So as the ground hardens with the sun, it becomes more passable for armored vehicles so they can fire and maneuver. So I think the more we get towards summer, the more likely the attack will come in a counteroffensive or multiple counteroffensives. That's what happened last August and September in Kharkiv and Kherson.
The Russians, of course, say that they have a master plan. You know, that right at the beginning, Kiev was all about not taking the capital. It was about stopping supplies, et cetera, et cetera. How is your Iraq?
Their plan was to capture Kyiv within a week. They were making restaurant reservations. Russian officers were making restaurant reservations for the next weekend.
They deny that.
They did.
How is your experience in Iraq, in Tikrit? You were Commerce Officer, U.S. Army 42nd Infantry Division. How has that helped you understand the battle in Ukraine? Because arguably, one could say the Americans lost in Iraq. It's lost in every war, Vietnam, Afghanistan, wherever.
I would definitely disagree with that. We won the war. By 2010, we had zero casualties the whole year in Iraq. We had won the war. We decided to give it up politically. Very different way to look at things.
Dan Rice, I'll stop you there. More from the U.S. veteran who has advised Ukraine's armed forces commander-in-chief, General Zelensky, after this break.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Putin is on offense. Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Dan Rice, the former special advisor to Ukraine's armed forces commander-in-chief, General Zelensky. Do you think shock and awe style tactics by the Russians, if they bombed Kiev, the capital, just as the Americans destroyed Baghdad, the health ministry, the education ministry, do you think that's where Putin is making his mistake? He needs to go in and just carpet bomb the capital of Ukraine, just as the Americans did Baghdad?
I would challenge almost every word of that sentence question. So, no, you know, the Americans, we liberated Iraq and we tried to keep casualties to a minimum. We never attacked civilian targets intentionally. Very different. Russians only attack civilian targets for the most part in Kyiv. They're not attacking anything military in Kyiv because there really is nothing military. So when you send 25 cruise missiles on May 9th for Victory in Europe Day at Kyiv, of which Raytheon shot down 23 of 25. So the air defenses are getting much, much much better. But they're attacking all civilian targets. It's entirely different. The U.S. didn't attack, especially, I mean, maybe one or two accidental errant bombs, which you have in any
war. The U.S. did not attack civilian facilities in Afghanistan, in Iraq.
No, they never attack civilian facilities intentionally knowing.
There were tens of millions killed, wounded, or displaced by U.S. policies.
They're not tens of millions. They're not tens of millions.
Killed, wounded, or displaced.
That statistic is way, way off for those wars. No,
the United Nations has the displacement figures. You just mentioned that. Actually, in January, and there is a propaganda war about the civilian killing, of course. Sure. What did you make? Have you heard of the report of 38 killed or wounded by U.S. supplied HIMARS against a Novaya civilian hospital in eastern Ukraine in January? Are the Ukrainians actually targeting civilian infrastructure? Because I know Zelensky has signed into law banning journalists from the front line. Why would he do that?
You know, there's 1,300 registered journalists within Ukraine. So journalism has been promoted and supported. And I know this because the former chief of strategic communications is a friend of mine. So they have registered and they have allowed. Now, when you're about to go on a counteroffensive and you don't put a bunch of people out there with satellite phones that can all radio back to, XYZ station in different places, you're about to go on a counteroffensive and your kids' lives are at risk. But no, they've done a phenomenal job overall, I think, in helping to try to communicate to the world exactly what is happening in real time. The Russians, I mean, it's all complete disinformation. I mean, you can see the stuff being circulated by the Russians. I mean, they're pretty good at it. That's what actually their biggest strength is, disinformation, misinformation.
It a strength? Because I think most people in NATO countries would say that the Russians are the bad guys here. Has it not been successful? I mean, they've banned, obviously there's a First Amendment in the United States, but in Europe and Britain, they've banned RT, television and so on, they've been able to ban all news coming from Russia. Is it worse in the United States? Is there a growing constituency who are doubting the war aims of Washington and Ukraine?
I mean,
you just said it was successful. The Russian
Well, it's
propaganda.
Successful in that it's successful that it, like, you can hear it in some of your questions. So they are very successful in making people think that some of the things they put out are correct, and they do it very effectively because they're led by a KGB colonel. Like, he spent his career in the KGB, so their government is more focused on that type of thing that he grew up learning as a Soviet KGB officer. So they're very good at it. Now, you can only hide the truth so long when it's so heinous, the things they're doing. When they're saying they're liberating Russian speakers. Well, everybody in Ukraine spoke Russian because the Russians occupied it under the Soviet Union. So that's a good excuse to take back all of the Soviet Union, including Latvia, Lithuania.
I think there were Russian speakers before the Soviet Union in the landmass of where Ukraine. Yeah, on this, you've said the Russian military reflects Russian society. You think it's a bankrupt culture, morally bankrupt, and the intention is to kill women, children, elderly. What do you make of the banning of Russian literature in presumably in the environ of the American university in Ukraine?
Well, the first thing I'd say is you challenged that there were Russian speakers in Ukraine prior to that. Well, the Soviet Union controlled Ukraine, basically for the last nearly 100 years. So, of course, they forced Russian upon them. They made everybody learn it in school. They taught them all their propaganda-based non-truths. So that they were not telling the truth, trying to institutionalize this. But if you look back, if you want to look back on history, I mean, the history of Ukraine is much older than the history of Moscow.
As Russians agree, and big three general secretaries of the Communist Party were Ukrainian. No, I'm just asking you, though, what do you feel as the president of the American university in Ukraine when Dostoevsky books are being destroyed down the street?
Well, I'm always a supporter of free truth and free speech, that the truth will make it free, and that, we will not ban free speech on campus whatsoever. I mean, people, if they have opposing views, they should voice them, and the best ideas are accepted. So, we'll be running the university just like
American
university.
But what do you feel personally, knowing that Tolstoy is being burnt or destroyed down the street from the faculty?
Well, you're the first one to tell me that. I did not know that. So
this was covered everywhere. It's covered in U.S. media.
No, I haven't seen that. And I also question, when something's covered like that, What did that mean? Like, was the government banning it, or what? Who did it, and when and why? So I was not aware of that. What I have seen is things like they have implemented laws because the Russians have used the excuse that they invaded to liberate Russian speakers. They have said that vendors cannot speak Russian. They all must speak Ukrainian. So they're basically trying to say, look, we are Ukraine. You can't allow Putin to keep coming invading, you know, every 7 years because people are speaking Russian. So they are forcing Ukraine to be the main state language, which I actually agree with.
What? So yeah. What? That's like Spanish in Texas, isn't it? Because obviously
if Mexico was invading us, if Mexico was invading us with an armed force, which some question whether they are now, but if they were invading us with an armed force saying Spanish that we're coming
in California,
I think it would be considered.
Texas.
I mean, I think the Democratic United States government would have to consider all actions.
I think that would be against the U.S. Constitution. I'm sorry.
That wouldn't be able to be debated.
I don't think any Supreme Court would allow that, but hopefully.
We also don't have an existential threat. That's a massive armored force that's invading, trying to rape, kill, pillage, destroy the culture. It's not just a military war. It's a military, political, economic, and religious war. So if you don't think that the Russian Orthodox Church is heavily involved, mostly with spies. So
you agree with the persecution of the Russian Orthodox Church's leaders as alleged by those who support Luhansk and Donetsk and so on?
I didn't say that. I didn't say agree with persecution. I agree that everybody should be investigated, that there's lots of people that you have to investigate in a situation like this where you have an active kinetic operation, but you also have guerrilla warfare from both sides. So you have to investigate people, and that's what you do. And
okay, so, the fundamental military question, as we're coming out of time, when people are pushed into a corner, as a military man, I think you'll know what people do. Most of humanity refused to vote to condemn Russia at the United Nations General Assembly when the events of February last year happened. Why are you so convinced that if the counteroffensive is successful, no tactical, nuclear or tactical, conventional but high-powered missile will not be aimed at the capital of Ukraine or even suppliers of weapons, countries that supplied weapons to, I mean, the Nord Stream, obviously, pipeline explosion, the news about that's in Russia all the time. Why are you so convinced that these countries will be fine, or even United States interests more widely, Ramstein base in Germany, is safe?
I'm not. I think Russia's out of control. I think there's a chance they could use a tactical nuke. I think there's a chance they could melt down the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. I think the world has to agree that we can't be held hostage by a nuclear power.
That would affect Russia if they did that, though. The Zaporizhzhia.
Well, it would affect southern Russia, which he doesn't really care about. So he only cares about St. Petersburg and Moscow. So a little bit of nuclear fallout in the southern part of Russia is not going to bother Putin. He's been known to kill his own people. He kills his own people all the time. So that's really... He kills them not only at home, but he kills them abroad. I mean, these are facts.
Well, obviously, he would deny that. But so you're saying that it is a possibility that your advice to the commander-in-chief of Ukrainian forces, which presumably included the need for a counteroffensive, could destroy the earth? Because you've just countenanced the idea of a nuclear assault.
No, you've just taken four different giant leaps of faith. Putin using a tactical nuke is up to him. The question is, what does the West do when he becomes an aggressor and takes over a neighbor and rapes, pillages, loots, takes the children?
Isn't that the reason why China and Russia don't attack the United States when it illegally invades Iraq? Because the United States has nuclear weapons. This is the idea of a deterrent. But what you're advising to General Zelensky is...
The invasion of Iraq, nobody ever expected us to take the ground and hold it for our own purposes. That's what Russia's doing here. That's an aggressor nation. We're a liberator nation. Everybody knew we were going in. We were not going to stay there. And we didn't. We won the war and we didn't stay there. We could have taken all the oil. We didn't. We never take the resources of the countries that we help liberate, whether it's France
I think most of the world arguably would probably beg to differ on that, whether it be Libya, Syria, or Afghanistan or whatever. Why no peace talks? Why is John Kirby saying he's against peace talks, the Chinese plan for peace talks, negotiations destroyed?
There's no negotiation. He invaded. The same dictator was there in 2014 when he invaded. The same guy is here in 2022. All the land he took in 2014 and 2022 needs to be retrieved back and needs to be liberated by Ukraine. So until he's gone, there's no discussion. You don't negotiate with a madman who's an aggressor with the nuclear weapons threatening to use them. You just say, we will beat you on the battlefield, and we will.
You just said we will. Do you think Ukraine would immediately lose if it wasn't for the European Union, Britain, and the United States arming Ukraine to the teeth?
I think there should have been never a war here because guaranteed.
No, I just asked a question there.
There would never have been an invasion had we lived up to our obligation under the 1994 Budapest Accords, which guaranteed the safety in exchange for their nuclear weapons. Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons, which were their defense against Russia. They gave them up because we said we would defend them. We didn't in 2014. Now in 2022.
So you'd prefer Ukraine to have nuclear weapons now?
No, no. I would prefer we had signed.
Well, you believe nuclear weapons are a deterrent, but nuclear weapons aren't a deterrent because you've just expressed the point that what is needed now is to continually arm Ukraine to fight Russia.
You're jumping from subject to subject so quickly, we can't focus on one of them. I mean, if you actually look at Alfred Nobel's beliefs, Alfred Nobel, the Nobel Peace Prize, he believed in deterrence. And he hoped that someday, and this is the 1800s, he hoped someday there would be weapons that would be so extreme that both sides would not actually attack each other. And that's actually what has happened in the Cold War. Now, you had mutual assured destruction when Ukraine had nuclear weapons. In the U.S.'s efforts to get non-proliferation, to reduce the number of countries, we gave a guarantee along with Britain and Russia that Ukraine would stay free. We didn't live up to it. When we signed the 1994 Budapest Accords, we should have put an international force along the border, just like we have in the DMZ in Korea. You put an international force there, Russia's not going to attack it. They didn't have to join NATO.
The Minsk Accords was arguably what Russia believed. And of course, Angela Merkel, the former chancellor, said that was just for NATO to arm to continually kill people in Donbass. How many Ukrainians have been killed? Estimates are between 157,000 to 300,000 Ukrainians dead. Would this war still be going on if NATO stopped arming Zelensky?
If NATO stopped arming Zelensky, the 38 million people would be occupied and terrorized, and the country of Ukraine would cease to exist, and they would be occupied. And I mean, he had 24 torture chambers in Kherson alone. You know, this is an occupying force that would have been raping, pillaging, and looting. Yes, if NATO didn't supply, yes, Ukraine would have fallen. Absolutely. That's a military fact. Nobody disputes that. The only way that Ukraine could keep going is the brave Ukrainian soldiers, trained by the West, and only the Ukrainians are fighting and dying. And they're dying not just for Ukraine. They're dying for Moldova. They're dying for Poland. They're dying for Sweden, Finland. They are dying because the Russian aggressor is on the move again, and nobody's safe. And they all realize it. And you have some amazing leadership, like the president of Poland. These are leaders that are stepping up and who realize that they're protecting their people. They're protecting their nation by arming Ukraine and fighting the Russians in the country they just invaded. And they can't stop till the invader is gone, that the aggressor with nuclear weapons is gone. And that comes with it some really tough bad versus worse decisions. These are not easy things. When you try to put it in a binary argument, it's almost impossible to argue. The reality is, this war is an elective war on Putin's fault. He was the invader in 2014. He was the invader in 2022. He needs to go from office. Hopefully the Russian people will get rid of him.
Well, clearly he's very popular, and many people believe that people are dying because there are no peace negotiations. But Dan Reif,
I don't know anybody that's educated about the subject that believes that. That's ridiculous. You're gonna actually stop the fighting to give up the land that they just invaded and stole? That just encourages the comeback for more.
Dan Reif, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday with the Putin Paradox author, Professor Richard Sakwa, for a different view on how the war in Ukraine is going. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.